All right, so we're here for our final share in the Kashrus series. We're going to try to have a full wrap up at the very end, but right now we're looking to finish out the last bit on Hechsher Kalim. We'll do a little bit on glass as well, hopefully, and then go through all of our topics and see if we finish out. So last week we spoke about the mitzvah, the Sama of Hechsher Kalim. Comes from the same sitting in the Torah in Parshas. We said Matos, from the Mechama of Midyan. The Jews ended up with a bunch of kalim, six different types of metal kalim, and we had two mitzvahs coming out of those sukkim. There's mitzvah of Tevilas kalim and the mitzvah of Hechsher kalim. Hechsher kalim, we thought, on the face of it, was very much a practical din, that there's tam balua, there's absorbed tam either on the inside or around the outside, according to a malamit, of these kalim. And if you were to use them, Nistama, maybe Binyama, Koso somewhere, if you're going to use them without kashering, then you're going to be tasting the trace taste, you're going to be tasting shellfish and pork and ham and whatever it is when you use those kalim. And obviously that's a problem. Let's assume Khan kicker is there right up, that the taste of something is just as bad as the thing itself, the issue itself. And therefore, you need to get the taste out. And we said there are three ways to get the taste out, from the easiest to the most difficult, and from the most surface level to the most, I guess, the most intense. One level was Mariko Shiva, washing it well under water, cold water, but some level with soap, washing it well to get whatever is on the outside off. A deeper level was Hagala, that actually gets any taste which is absorbed on the inside out without water above the level of Yad. So let us go, draws the taste out, and hopefully it doesn't get back into the Kli itself. We spoke about that a little bit. And then the third level was Libun, taking the blowtorch to it, to the Kli. And we said that the main klal was Kibolo Kas Polto. The same way taste goes into a Kli, that's how you generally need to get it out. It might be different. There's machlokas about Hetera Bala versus Yisura Bala. We decided not to go into that. That's a little bit more relevant, I think, by Pesach time. That comes up a little bit more, but in general, Kibolo Kas Polto, the same way it goes in, it needs to come out. So if you use anything to use, let's say, with a grill, where there's direct flame, the only way to kasher that Kli would be with direct flame, with Libun, the Hagdara, the baseline, the level of Libun that you need, the level of heat that you need for something to be considered Libun, is hot enough for sparks to fly. You don't literally need sparks flying. We say that generally, like a self-cleaning oven accomplishes the same level of heater, accomplishes the same thing, just without the theatrics, without the flying sparks, which is cool. But a self-cleaning oven does get hot enough to do that. But often, it is not so practical to do a full libun on many of your household kalim, because you don't really want to be taking blowtorches to them. And also, there are some kalim which just can't stand up to that type of heat. It's very intense. That can be a little bit difficult. There's a kind of mid-level called libun kal. Libun kal is in between the heat of hagala and the heat of a full libun. Generally, we assume that a libun kal is equivalent or accomplishes the same thing as hagala. It's just sometimes a little bit more relevant or a little bit more practical than hagala might be. We also pointed out that hagala and libun work in very different ways. Hagala pulls taste out of the kli, but it's still there, whereas it's, at least in the water, we spoke about four or five ways you need to avoid that taste which gets absorbed into the water, giving you problems. Whereas libun, literally destroys the taste where it is. We said that's why you might be able to do full libun. Theoretically, you can do full libun on a kli charet, if not for the fact that we're afraid it might crack and you won't do a good job. You might be afraid it's going to crack and you might do a good job. That's why we say generally don't do libun on kli charet. But theoretically, it would work because you're destroying any taste which is absorbing the walls. Even though it's so absorbent, you're not going to be able to get all the taste out. You could theoretically destroy all the taste inside. So they're working in two very different ways. Important thing to be aware of. We said last week, there's like a, let's say, a little bechina. We said last week that there's one thing you walked out of this year with, and maybe even if you walked out of the entire series with, one thing to remember about Hechsher Kalim.
Wait 24 hours.
Wait 24 hours, very good. But before kashering any kli, no matter what happens, you should always wait 24 hours. That's true if you find a fork on the wrong side of the dishwasher, in the wrong cycle, the wrong side of the sink, if you know that you just scraped up a pot, if you're kashering your kalim for Pesach, and no, it doesn't matter what, it doesn't matter what the situation is, always wait 24 hours from the time that the thing, the kli, utensil became trace, and when you actually do the hasher, that basically means you basically have a fail-safe to make sure that you don't have any problems with hasher itself. If you don't wait 24 hours, there is at least potential that you number one, have not actually kashered the fleet, and number two, you may actually have traced up whatever receptacle you were using to try to take care of it. Obviously not good, so always just wait 24 hours and make your life easy. Okay. So just to pick up where we left off, we were towards the end of Sif Vav, we were trying to use the order of the Shulchan Aruch. A difference between Hechsher and Tevila. You don't generally expect to find too many overlaps, although when I was preparing for this, I actually did come across one and I was surprised to find. You generally don't find too many overlaps between Hechsher and Tevila. They're looking to accomplish very different things. One of the things we actually spoke about last week was the order of Hechsher and Tevila. If the order is ma'akiv, you would expect, and really the way it's presented is first you do Hechsher, followed by Tevila. And the Rashba actually had a lashon of, if you don't do it that way, then it's ki'ilu tovel, b'sheretz b'yado, and it wasn't effective, you'd have to do it again. We don't pass in that way, we think that it's not really ma'akiv, but that is one discussion about how they relate to each other. Here's the difference between Hechsher and Tevila. We pointed out when we were talking about Tevila's Kalim 2 weeks ago that the entire kli needs to be in the mikvah at the same time. If you have a enormously large kli that doesn't fit in the mikvah, then that's a problem. You have no way around that. The only way to fix that kli is either to break it in a way, have a Jewish uman, anybody can break it. If you have to break it in a significant way so it's totally unusable, and then have a Jewish uman put it back together, that would give it the status of coming into existence beyond Yisrael, as opposed to ever being owned by, we wouldn't see it as ever being owned by a guy, it's kilu, a new kli, or you'd have to pull the shtick of lending it to a guy, and then, or giving it to a guy as a full matana, and then borrowing it back. If you can't get a full kli into the mikvah, then there's no way of doing tevila. And that was the chatzisa problem. That was the when we spoke about the human equivalent. That was the reason for the mikvah lady. That was a very important din. Holding the kli. I just heard a story from one of the Shanalis guys went to that random like board that they have on the top of what was it by Zilberman, the Kalim mikvah near Zilberman, and he unfortunately didn't come to this year and didn't know how you're supposed to properly and safely pasher your kalim without dropping it, your kalim without dropping them. So he thought that in major adin you need to totally let go of the kli for I don't know, a split second so that the entire kli is enveloped and surrounded by the water. He did that. What do you think happened? It is currently hanging out at the bottom of the pass of that kalim mikvah, and it does not look like there's any chance of going to be getting it back. Unfortunately, we had said that the easy way to do that is to put your hand into the mikvah, say your right hand into the mikvah, get it wet with the mikvah water, then holding the kli in your left hand, put that into the mikvah water as well, and then pass it from your left hand to your right hand. Since your right hand is already wet with the mikvah water, and is actually in the mikvah itself, even when you do hold on, and even if you hold on tightly to the kli, to the mug itself, we see it as being fully enveloped by the water, and therefore you don't have a problem. Unfortunately, he didn't know that, and he lost his mug. Chaval. So that was true by Tevila Kalim. When it comes to Hechsher Kalim, that din does not apply. It makes sense. It's much more, it's a practical din, it's not a traditional custom. All you're trying to do, we're assuming, is get out those bleos. So there's no problem with you doing Hagalah on half of a kli, picking it out of the water, flipping it around, and doing Hagalah on the other half of the kli. You can do this with Liban. It doesn't really matter. It does not need to be a full immersion. There's no Gezeirah Kasuv of having the kli in all at one time. You're not rebirthing the kli. You're getting out kliot. You can do section by section. You can even do Hagalah on, like, you have to have, like, a really long book. Maybe, like, you know those, like, long matzo things? Those, like, really long matzah shovels that they use to get the matzah out of the oven. So for some reason, then you want it to kasher. I think they actually do this. I think they kasher them every, I know year to year they kasher them. I'm not sure if they do in between sessions. That would be like a summer use area, but we have summer use areas for Pesach. So let's say you want to kasher that entire thing. So it's huge. How many goes can fit this, like, huge, long matzah shovel thing? So what you could theoretically do is you could dip one end. Yeah, it's not even mikvah. We're doing hechsher. You have like a pot of boiling water. You can't fit this huge 6 foot tall matzah shovel into like a pot of boiling water, no matter how big your pot is. So what you could do is you boil up the water, you dip the kli in, let's say part one, and then you pull it out, flip it around, and you get the part two. And now you have like a 2 foot section in the middle of the handle that's not going to fit into the pot of water, no matter what you do. Theoretically, you can do irui. But if it's, no, that, even that wouldn't work.
You can't pour it on.
Iru would be pouring on, but Iru is a lower level deep. So if you're looking for the highest level of heat that you can get from Hagala, that's not going to be enough. Don't think this is like Halas Marsha, this is what people do. I'm just trying to give an example, and that's like a good cleat because it's huge. So what can you do with that middle section? You can actually do Libud on just that 2 foot section, and you'll have this cleat where part one was done was kashered with Hagala, part two was kashered with Libud, and part three was again kashered by Hagala and all that three different points. So important to recognize that your hefsher, as opposed to the tevila, hefsher can be done in parts and sections as opposed to tevila. For tevila, the entire clean needs to be in the mikvah all at one time.
How long can that be in the mikvah?
Oh, great question. That's a fantastic question. That is in the mikvah or in hefsher for hefsher kailah? Tevila is like a millisecond. That doesn't need time. However, for hefsher, that's a much bigger question. That's discussed by the Rishonim. Because, okay, remember, what we're trying to do, we're assuming, and we spoke about this last time, that the Gezeres HaKasuvah is a fractal din, that would be re-steamed potency on stone, potentially stone kalim. Obviously, we don't hold that way, but it was an interesting svara. So we're assuming that we're going for a very practical pulling out blios. So, like, how long does it take for the blios to, wake up, get moving, and finally make their way out into the water? Are they quick blios? Are they slow blios? Are they heavy blios? Are they light blios? Like, does that even matter? So it is in my focus Rishonim. Is there a certain amount of time you need to wait? If you just read, I think it was just reading the tour, I think, it actually sounded like there is a certain amount of time. It could have been before the tour, I don't remember. There are sources which make it sound like there's a certain amount of time and we just don't really know what it is. So which obviously makes it very difficult. There are some, so there are basically two approaches. There are some who say, since we don't know how much time, we should just like try to figure out how much time is going to be, and they try to do numbers. On the other hand, they say that no, it's not really a time question, it's just getting it fully, getting it into the water, and it kind of happens automatically. And since there's no real way of knowing more time, less time, too much time, not enough time, whatever it is, then we just assume, put it in for, I think we're Milana said 3 seconds maybe, and then you can pull it out. But maybe, even if you can't get 3 seconds for whatever reason, once you get it in, you can pull it right out and it doesn't matter. Some of those sources which say that you should be waiting a specific amount of time actually turn it into a chumrah. Because if you leave it in for too long, not only do the blios have the opportunity to come out of the kli, they actually have the opportunity to go right back into the kli. So if you're assuming that's how it works, that might actually create a problem. Again, generally we don't really assume that. We assume that once they're out, they're basically out, unless you're letting them sit for a while. It also has to do with the temperature, if the water's boiling or not boiling. All of those are factors. Part of it is also that we assume that as long as the kli is letting blios out, then it's not available to let blios come in. These are all things which are discussed, and it's hard to visualize exactly what we're talking about. That is a great question. That's definitely something which is discussed in the sources. Okay, so I think we're going to try to end off with kashering knives. So I wish I had an avodah zara. Is there an avodah zara in here? Okay, fine. So I'll leave. How quickly can you get it? The very, very end of the Avodah Zarah, yeah? Okay, then it's worth reading the story inside just because it's a lot of fun. It's also, so Avodah Zarah as a Mesefta, number one, it's a great Mesefta, a lot of good Agadata, a lot of interesting Dinin. If you're interested in how we relate to non-Jews, that's definitely the Mesefta to learn. And it also has a lot of very practical, what's it called? It also has a lot of very practical dinim. A lot of practical kashrus dinim. Some of them are the zeres we spoke about, like fishel akum and pas akum and gvinas akum, polav akum. All those things are obviously going to be in the middle of the bazaara. But also just a lot of good bleo stuff and a lot of hefsher stuff. A lot of that stuff comes up over the course of the Tafsir of the Bazaara. When you're learning kashrus, then obviously your main text is chulin, and not only chulin, your main text is like the 8th miracle chulin, you really don't move much out of there. And you get in tarubos, you move into the 7th parak, which is the parak right before, parakid anashe, but that's like really almost the only parts of chulin that you touch, but you're literally sitting on those parakim for the entire time. Once in a while, almost the only other mesef that they're looking at, a little bit of psachim, but the other main mesef that they're looking at is mesef of the Zara. So there's really a lot there. It's a fun mesef to do. Highly recommend it. Okay. Just to read these last few lines. This is hilarious. So the Mishnah teaches, it's like written in English. Hasakin Safa Bihi Torah. If you have a knife, all you need to do is like sharpen the outside, and the knife is going to be tahor. Amar Rav Ukva bar Chama, benoata asar famim bekarka. So it's actually unclear. Is he adding to or giving an alternative suggestion? Is it sharpen a knife and dig it into the ground 10 times, or dig it into the ground 10 times? We pass an or, but there are sheets that say and. I think Rashi says and. You have two things to do to pass your knife. Either you could just sharpen the outside, or you could take your knife, dig it 10 times, or drive it 10 times into karka kasha, into hard ground. It needs to be hard ground, and then that can get off whatever is on the outside of the knife. Let's say you just use that knife to carve like a trait bird that's eaten. Who knows? Eagle. You're a wilderness guy, you just caught an eagle and you carved up an eagle and you want to pass it that knife. So if you drive it into karka kasha, into hard ground 10 times, then you would that would pass your the knife. Ben actually said that you could actually use like a stainless steel like scrubbing brush or sponge, anything which actually like is very, very hard. Not a sound sponge, one of those like harder ones, one of those Zinta ones. So that would accomplish the same thing, give it a bunch of good scrapes. That would also work. Amr Kahanu was back in the office, and Bugumos, we can't have any like pits or holes, pock marks in the knife, because that would hide some particles, and the ground wouldn't be able to get rid of those. Tanam Yasin, back in the office, and Bugumos, Nasa, Sarapam, and Bekarka, Amr Kahanu, Breder Yeshua, that whole but stone in. So Ravuna, Breder Yeshua says, Einachinani, this works. This is good. However, it's only good for eating cold food. Any bleos in the night, you're not getting out just by driving into the ground. It's discussed, but let's assume for now that it's only good for eating cold food. And then, so this is good to know, but not like a full-fledged kashering. It's only getting off things that are on the surface of the night.
Can you use it with cold food afterwards, or only gets rid of it if you use it?
No. It allows you to use it with cold foods afterwards. Even if it was used with hot, it allows you to use it with cold foods. What's surprising is that you can even use it for Dabar Karis. I mean, so the Dabar Karis has this capability of drawing out bleos. So how can you use it with the Dabar Karis if we're assuming there's still trace bleos inside the knife and they're just not coming out when using with cold, but we're not going to go into that. Okay, here's the story. Kiha Demar Yehuda Ubati Bar Tuvi. This then relates to the story that we have with Mar Yehuda and Bati Bar Tuvi. And what's funny is that this is what you have to read when you're making a siyum on, assuming you're doing if you're making a siyum on the Tavzav Azara, like this is the story, you have to read and explain, and it's a lot of fun. Mar Yehuda, Bati Bar Tuvi, Havu Yatsi, Kamedish, Vor Malka. These two people, these two Jews, were sitting in front of Shavur Malka, who was the king of Persia. I used to with Kamayu Esroga, and he run him an Esrog. So an Esrog is a citrus fruit, and we were speaking about Deborah Harif, who said that, at least according to some Shitos, citrus is maybe Harif, maybe sour, a little bit different than Harif. That's something which is a big discussion. So they brought an Esrog. They brought an Esrog in front of Shavur Malka, the king. So what did... I lost it? Yes. Yeah. I, they brought it before then, and they Pasak Achal, Pasak Vehavli, Lebati Bar Tuvi. So the king cut a slice from this Esrog, and he ate it. Then he cut another slice, he gave it to Bati Bar Tuvi. Then, Hazar Datsa Asari Zimni Ba'ara, Pasak Havli Mar Yehuda. Then he took the knife, drove it into the ground 10 times, cut off a slice, and gave it to Mar Yehuda. So Bati Bar Tuvi was like offended. He said to the king, what, you don't think I'm a Jew? I'm not just as makrid on the laws of kashrus as Mar Yehuda is? Amar le, Mar kim le begabe. Umar lo kim le begabe. So the king, Shmur Malka, said, I know that I'm confident that he is holding an halacha, or that he cares about this stuff. And you, lo kim le begabe, maybe, I don't know, I don't have as much of a confidence, I don't know you as well, whatever it is. Ika de Amri, and this is the funny line, Ika de Amri was another version of what the king said too. Bati Bar Tuvi, Amar le, Idkar, Mayavadasa, Buburta. I know exactly what you did last night. It's like, whoa, what does that mean? So apparently, I think Rashi explains it, as far as he has that apparently Persian practice was part of their Hachnasas Orchim. They would send a woman, each of their guests, at night, and they could, I don't know, hang out, have a nice conversation, do whatever you do with a random woman, come to your room at night as part of the Persian half nefesh or from Krakus. So obviously it seems like Mar Yehuda said, no thank you, and Bati Bar Tuvi did not say, no thank you. So Shvur Malka, this like this harif message, harif about Esrog and Dabar Fire, this harif message of you can't be a from Jew in public and not in private. That if you're masked on certain things, you're kilu masked on certain things in public, but your private personality doesn't match that, you're eventually going to get called out on that, and I don't know. I think it's funny for Hilchos Kashrus, which is so often something which has public repercussions. You're inviting people over for Shabbos, which restaurants are you eating at, whatever it is. It's like a nice way to kind of end off that your public presentation of your religious self should very strongly match your inner experience or the way you're acting in private as well. But anyway, why was that Gemara relevant? Because we have this din. This is the source for this practice or this possibility of kashering a knife in a certain way by digging it into the ground 10 times. This actually led to a very strange misunderstanding that I don't know if you've ever seen this. Have you ever seen like utensils just hanging out in flower pots? Like the idea of like burying kaling to kasher them? So that is totally not a thing. They're like unclear where exactly that came from. The best suggestion is that some guy who didn't really know what was going on saw somebody who didn't know what was going on take a knife and drive it into the ground 10 times. And he's like, oh wow, that's so cool. I guess that works. And instead of going through the tircha of driving a knife into the ground 10 times, he just dug a little hole, put the knife in there. I don't know if you left it for 24 hours. I don't know if you have to water it every so often to make it grow. So you can grow a knife tree. That'd be fantastic. That'd be great. There's this misconception which kind of spread that you can kasher a kli by burying it in the ground. It's totally false. It's definitely not a thing. That's not how this works. It's specifically by driving into Karka Kasha and really 10 different points of the ground. You shouldn't be driving into the same hole. The whole point is the friction or the interaction with the hard dirt is getting off whatever shamnunis and whatever is crusted on the blade, and that's why you're going to be allowed to use it with cold. Even Deborah Fire is a little bit surprising, but that's what's behind it, that's what's going on. So don't think, if the next time you see this, next time you see like random kalim half buried in flower pots, don't be surprised that they're coming from this misconception. And if you know the person well, you can even explain to them, hey, let me read you this fantastic story in Avodah Zarah and explain what exactly is going on. That's how one way to kasher a knife. If we saw in the Gemara, if the knife has gumos, if there are nicks or holes or scratches where the tam or some of the stuff which is balua might hang out inside, and even after the mi'itza, even after digging it into the ground. When I say digging, I mean like plunging. Like you guys know what I'm talking about, right? It's like you take this and like 1, 2, 3, okay, good. Just getting into the ground, getting full blade in. So if it has gumos, it has these nicks or scratches, then it would not work. It also does not work if you wanted to use that knife for hot food or for shchita. Shchita, we assume the base, what is it, base hashchita is roteach. We assume that where you're cutting, it's so hot, and there's friction there, and there's heat there, body warmth. It's so hot that it does have, that heater, that area alone, has the potential to be, I think, bolea and mavlia. So you wouldn't be able to use a shechita knife this way. If you wanted to use a knife for hotter shechita, you would need to be malabing, or you would need to sharpen the entire thing. Serrated knives might be different. They're a lot harder to clean. There must have l'chachila, where machmer that sharpening is actually only considered like cleaning the surface, the same way digging into the ground allows you to use it cold. There must have l'chachila, if you only sharpen the surface of a knife, then you should only use it with cold as well. But yeah, but if you did cut hot food, then the food would be kosher as well. There's a big machlokas is hagala, helps for a knife. There's a stira and sugyos. There are a few ways to answer up the stira. It seems like generally you should be okay, that Hagala should be enough. If you can't do a great Livun, then you can do Livun as much as you can and then do Hagala. That would be good. But really, Livun's I think your best bet for knives in general. I would want to double check. I guess if this comes up, check with whoever. There may just be an assumption that knives are used directly with flames more often and then therefore would need Livun. But if you know that it's only been used for Hagala, I think you generally would be okay with Hagala. Okay.
What do you mean used for Hagala?
Used in the context of a bishul or cooking in water on a stove in a pot as opposed to directly with flames like on a grill or something. It kind of depends on the type of knife and what's going on. Yeah, Gabby? Have you ever washed serrated knives?
Yeah.
So there, it's just practically, it's just like stuff. So stabbing into the ground, I don't know if the serrations would count as a guma, because like each serration kind of protects the one behind it, like in the little valley it protects the little nick. So I'm not sure if that would be what we're talking about. But even if you're trying to wash it, it's just so much more difficult. So you're like you obviously the first step is to get off whatever be'ain is there, and if you can't get off the be'ain, then it's definitely going to be a big problem.
For an exit of the handle, how do you get it fully in the ground?
Say again?
For net that as a handle, how do you fully get all the way to the end?
Right, so I think that's part of the difficulty of libun. You can't really get all the way through. So you do. That's why I think the Ramad said, if you do libun as much as you can, then maybe do hagala for the rest, then that should cover your bases.
For the dirt, just whatever, like if the dirt only gets to a certain part of the knife, like just the shape of the knife, you should cut with the other half, but you can't use the knife at all.
Say again?
Like the knife is like this long and then this part's covered by the handle, but like it makes the next part a little more difficult to get to the dirt.
Right.
Would that part not be good then? Like the whole knife.
And then you should probably do either Hagala or Libun. I would imagine. Worth asking, that's what I would imagine. Okay, the last thing we want to talk about is glass kalim. So glass kalim show up in not in your Yoredeya, really, but this is in Or HaChaim, in the 451 and 452 are the Pesach dinim. If you're getting ready for Pesach and you want to kasher your kitchen, those are the simanim you need to learn. So there it says that glass does not need to be kashered because glass as a material is not balea. All you need to do is just rinse off the shmutz. So this is a huge machlokes between the Rav Yah and the Rabbeinu Yechiel. The Gemara doesn't really discuss the kashrus of glass. We said that it spoke about glass. We said tevila. Glass was necessary. Tevila for glass is necessary midir abanan because it's I think we said it shared similar properties as metal does. So they included in midir abanan, but it doesn't discuss the status of glass for hechsher kalim. If it's not balea though, then what possible problem could you have? So the Rav Yah says glass is not polea. If you guys remember from high school science and chemistry, they would use glass beakers because it's very helpful. Since the glass beakers are not polea, that's factual it seems, they're not polea, so the experiments aren't messed up with bleos, with other chemicals or other things. If weight is an issue, whatever it is, since nothing is absorbed into the walls of glass kalim, therefore you can be a lot more confident in your experiments. You know exactly what materials are being used, as long as you wash them well. So that's, what? Rabbeinu pointed out the chemical point. So it just seems like practically glass is not balea. There's also an Avos Tirf Nasan who says that glass is not balea, one of like three unique things about glass. That's the Rav Yah. The Rabbeinu Yechiel says, no, glass is balea and therefore can't be kashered through Hagalah. It's basically the exact same as Kairat, melted dirt versus melted sand, not much of a difference. So that's a big machlokes. It comes down to the Mechaber and the Ramah. The Mechaber says, takes the Rav Yah, glass is not bolea, and that's what Svaradim hold. So some Svaradim will actually use the same exact like plates, bowls, pots, Pyrex, whatever it is, the same glass for meat and milk. They'll use it for Pesach, the same thing that they use year-round, they'll use for Pesach, and they'll even use Tref Kalim with kosher food if they're at a hotel or whatever it is. They have a cloud of those glass is not bolea, and they're proud of their heritage, they'll use that kula whenever it comes up. Glass is not bolea, it doesn't matter what's going on. And this is my focus among contemporary Sephardic poskim about Pyrex. Pyrex is okay, when you get married and you have a wife, you'll know exactly what this is. You'll get it on your registry and you're not going to know why it's so special, but everyone will tell you, like, of course, we need a Pyrex, how can you not have a Pyrex? It's like this very convenient, it's like a serving dish that you can also put in the oven. It's very versatile, it's very temperature resistant, it's great. So my focus among contemporary Sephardic posting about Pyrex, maybe it's like glass. On the other hand, since it's comfortably used with such extreme heat, that maybe the extreme heat that it can be used with would be balea. Generally, people wouldn't be comfortable using glass with such extreme heat because of the chance that it might shatter. Pyrex is made in a way where that's not a concern. So some Sephardic poskim say that glass is only not balea at the heat that glass is used with. However, since the Pyrex, even though it's technically materially similar to glass, since it's used with such higher temperatures, maybe that would cause bleo. Yesh v'yesh, so you can ask your local Sephardi friends what their families do. That's an interesting question. But now, if you move over to Ashkenazim, this is all for Sephardim, and this is now part of my family, and my wife is Sephardi, who's Syrian, she's Sephardi, Flatbush, so this was very much a part of their day-to-day life. They have all their glasses. They definitely do like drinking glasses. I don't know if they really do. I have to check my wife. I don't know if they do like the actual like plates and stuff all the same. I think they do, but I'm not positive. With Ashkenazim, this is totally not a thing. The Ramah says the Yesh Machmirin that glass does absorb and ignores that can't be kashered through Hagala. So you, on the one hand, there is a Bliya. So that's bad, but on the other hand, it can't be kashered through Hagala. It makes sense if the Svara is, we're going to compare it to Klei Cheres. The same way Klei Cheres you can't kasher, so too, glass you're not going to be able to kasher. So there is an in-between shita that it absorbs, but it can be kashered, essentially saying that it's basically just like metal. But the same way glass absorbs, it also spits out. So the Shaar HaTzion quotes this from the Ra'ah in the Vedic Avayis, who comments on the Rashba's not the Mishmar Tobias. Rashba's Sefer on Issa Hetzer. Oh, you're right. Okay. The Rashba wrote a Sefer on Issa Hetzer, and the name is escaping me right now. The Ra'ah wrote notes, criticisms, comments called the Bedek Havayis. And then the Rashba actually responded in the Mishmeres HaBayis defending himself. So it's just an interesting back and forth. Usually they're all printed together by now. So the Ra'ah has that in-between shita for glass that it does absorb, but at the same time it could be kosher. So halacha l'maaseh for Ashkenazim, l'chatchila, we do hold like that Ramah. You should not be using glass kalim for both milk and meat because it's boleh and can't be kosher. What about with the bedi'evad? So there are a bunch of shitas, the Magen Avraham, the Taz, and the Mishnah Berurah. Magen Avraham says, if you did Hagalah, and this is the context of Pesach, if you did Hagalah, then the food that you cooked with those kalim would still be Pesachic. Really saying shita the ra'ah. The taz sounds like the evidence you could even rely on the machaber. Even if you didn't do hagalah, it wouldn't make the pesach big food chameit, meaning that even if you didn't do hagalah, it's still seen as b'di'evet, it's still seen as not chametzik. The Mishnah Berurah, in some case, pasim like the Magen Avraham. However, if there's hesed meruba and it's also Ibn Yomo, he says you can be makel like the taz. That's a classic theorem. If you once you have Ibn Yomo, everything's going to get a little bit more makel. Good.
Ibn Yomo and...
In general, what were the two things? It was hesed meruba. If you accidentally use the glass clean to like cook your entire seder, and then you like the roast for your seder, and then you realize that wait a minute, this is the one that I didn't kosher. This is my regular year-round glass, not my Pesach big glass. So that would be a big loss to throw out your entire roast. If you have to assume that it's chametzik, buy a new one, or it may not even be available to buy a new one. So in that type of the case, if it's both Pesach and Meruba and in a Binyamo, then you can assume, like the Taz, that the Mesher Adin seems like glass would not be Bolea. We would assume glass is not Bolea, and therefore it would not mess up your roast.
Just assume that all the burnt parts completely clean glass?
Yeah, this is assuming clean glass. Yeah, if it's not clean, then
that's the best. Even if you're a Gola, there's still like some like schmutz. That, like,
it shouldn't be. After our Gola, there shouldn't be any schmutz. If it was done right, it shouldn't be there. The last thing is that our Ashkenazim machmir about glass only Mishum Chomer the Pesach or year round. Right? You have to keep in mind that the things which are brought up in the context of Pesach and Mishnah Berurah, there's this idea of the Chomer, the Pesach, this extra level Chomer that we keep for the reasons we spoke about last week. So what would they do about year round? So there are a bunch of valid shitos. The Knesset HaGadolah says that the minhag is only to be machmir for Pesach but not year round. There are others who say the Chomer of course applies year round. There are those who say that year round you take the middle shita, that it absorbs, but it could also be kashered, and only on Pesach would we say that it can't be kashered. So the Shvil has to have the kind of like the golden ruler, like the I guess if you have your own personal family minhag, then great. But if you don't have the family minhag, here this is a good suggestion that l'chatchila you should be for Ashkenazim, obviously not for Sfaradim. That l'chatchila you should be machmir and not use glass going back and forth between meat and milk. If you have trade glass, you shouldn't use it for kosher, etc., things like that. But to the other, you would be allowed to be makel. For example, if chicken soup fell on a glass milk pot cover, then you can assume it's not the Leah. You can find, even if you have a Pyrex Galatian dish that hot milk fell on, you can still assume that it's not the Leah. Lechachila, drinking glasses, Mesama are fine as long as you're using them with cold at both meat and milk meals. Nobody ever puts like meat or hot milk in them. Anyway, mugs would be a different question, but just drinking glasses, even like a Sam Ashkenazi, Mesama can be make yoli. If you use a glass, drinking glass for cold at both milk and meat meals, Mesama that would be fine. So there are a bunch of different valid chitos for what to do about Ashkenazi, what to do about glass during the course of the entire year. That is something you should check with your family about, and otherwise kind of take that middle path, l'chachila b'diavad. So that I think concludes our series on kashrus. Just to run through the topics that we spoke about, we started with an introduction to Basar B'Cholav. We had there three times it says Basar Hashem B'Cholav Imo, the first of which we actually came up in last week's parsha. So each one is related to a different isser. There's a isser of bishul, an isser achila, and an isser hana'ah. And we spoke about which one of those is the ikr and which one is just the, which is there an ikr, is there a tafel, is one like the main thing, the others are just kind of gedarim to protect against them. Then we spoke about the definitions of basar b'chalav d'oraisa versus d'rabban. We spoke about the danger, the sakana of fish and milk, and the potential sakana of fish and meat. Spoke about Maris Ayin in the context of Basar B'Cholav, D'oraisa, D'rabbanan, might be a little bit different. This is actually a Purim sugya. They used to have, in the Shachtas, they used to have the practice of making chicken with almond milk and Purim, because in Havachu it looks like good chick, looks like you're eating Basar B'Cholav, ha ha ha. So when you were doing that, you would need to leave almonds around, because otherwise people might think it's actually Yisurim become mother on Purim for some reason, therefore maybe they would think it's actually Basar B'Cholav, so you should leave around almonds to avoid the Basar B'Cholav issue. Spoke about two people eating milk and meat at the same table, which can definitely come up in the Rova. We had our survey of what the best restaurants in the Rova are and how you can avoid that being a problem. We spoke about the different shitos of waiting between milk and meat. One, what was it? We had Maker Adin according to Tosfos in the Rambam, 6 hours, not really even waiting at all, just ending the meal. Then we had 1 hour, 3 hours, 5 hours, 5.5 hours, and 6 hours, the Rosh Shitos. We explained where those came from. The concept of not bar not and how it comes up practically, what happens if we actually accidentally cooked in the wrong pot. Dinim for microwaves, ovens, concepts of Recha and Zeya, and then countertops and hot food, how you should really not be putting down hot food on the same parts of the countertop. That really, even though taste only goes from kli to kli with rotev, still we would avoid having them interact with each other directly. So you should have different areas of the countertop that you put things down on. We just spoke about glassware, we spoke about the Zafrachayas, and we spoke about both Hefsher Kalim and Tevilat Kalim, and somewhere in there we also spoke about Bishol Akum. We had a fantastic series. Hopefully you guys learned a lot. Just practically, what's the question, just to be aware of the concepts, to be aware of the sugyos that are out there. This was not meant to be obviously like a smicha level kind of thing. This is more just to be aware of what the concepts are, how to ask a question, what the questions that are worth asking are, or that you're meant to be asking are, and you got a sense of how pervasive this specific area of halacha is in like day-to-day Jewish life, and the more you get out into having your own house or these types of things, the more these questions are going to come up. Hopefully you guys get the opportunity to learn this stuff in a real way. And smicha, the rest is fantastic, highly recommended if that's where life takes you. But okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to get to go over this stuff, the chazak stuff from last year, to talk to Rabbi Nar, to clarify based on a lot of the questions you guys were asking. Gave me the opportunity to clarify this stuff, and hopefully it was beneficial for you guys. I appreciate the opportunity to get this over.
Thank you.